I'm Bob Franklin. Thanks very much for joining me. This is Like It Is. Today we're going to take you to Lowndes County, Alabama, to speak with Josephine Bolin McCall, whose father was lynched in Lowndes County on December 4th, 1947. Josephine Bolin McCall was 5 years old when her father was lynched. It was not until she was 60 years old that she discovered an article in the Chicago Defender describing the real reason her father was killed. Quote, "Enraged whites, jealous over the success of a Negro, are believed to be the lynchers of Elmo Bolin." Crusading anti-lynching journalist Ida B. Wells wrote, "Those who commit the murders write the reports." My conversation now with Josephine Bolin McCall. Lynching was rampant. Black people stepping outside of the boundaries of acceptable behavior routinely found themselves facing lynch mob. Today, we hear one such lynching. My guest, Josephine Bolin McCall. How are you today?
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Thank you very much. I want to give most of the show to you. So I'd like to start by asking you to share your recollections of the lynching of your father, the place, date, location, and if you can, the climate in the community where he lived.
The date of the lynching was December 4th, 1947 in Lounsboro, Alabama. And the racial climate at that time was mixed. My father's extreme success, which led to his lynching, was based upon the assistance received from several whites. And by that, I mean he was able to buy tractor trailer trucks, which were ordinarily would not have been sold to blacks. And he was able to operate the trucks on US highways and say that they belonged to a white man. And at the same time, there were Klansmen in the area who did not want to see blacks succeed and were especially infringed upon blacks who were doing well, better than they were economically.
So would you say that your father was kind of acting out of place, not knowing his place as it has been referred in the South, when an African-American person did not ascribe to the dictates of the larger community? Would you say that your father was acting out of his place, though a successful business person himself?
Very definitely. He was acting out of his place because not only was he a successful farmer, he was hiring black workers to work on his farm. He was hiring black truck drivers to drive his trucks. And he hired blacks to work in the store that he was operating. So, and then in addition to that, he started a milk business where he transported milk from the farmers to the dairies in Montgomery, which was a nearby town. And those persons from whom he obtained the milk received milk checks. So those persons were not as dependent on sharecropping and on white farmers as they were. So as he moved up the ladder to success, he brought others along with him. So he very definitely was out of his place.
And the way, tragically, African-Americans were treated when they got, quote, out of their place was by lynching, brutally. Could you take the audience to that occurrence and the subsequent impact to your father as well as to your family?
Yes. And at this time, I think it's very necessary to explain to many people in the audience what a lynching is, because until I wrote my book about my father having been lynched, I was under the impression that a lynching was a noose around the neck, but that is not the definition of a lynching at all. A lynching definition includes the number of persons who commit the crime and that there's no due process. So I want the audience to understand that my father was shot 6 times with a pistol and once in the back with a shotgun. And his lynching had been well planned by the Lowndes County community. And when the one of the persons who did the shooting said that my father insulted his wife over the telephone, basically admitted that he didn't have a motive. But when they had the inquiry, he was not even indicted for the murder. So that was planned from the beginning. And as far as the impact on my family, we went from prosperity to poverty almost overnight, because the living that we were accustomed to, being well established as a entrepreneur, philanthropist, and the Montgomery Advertiser described him in the news article that was written about his death as one with an excellent reputation in the community. And that was on the front page. So all of those things attributed to his demise. And I think you might have asked another part of that question, so you might have to repeat that.
Sure. I wanted to know the reaction when your family learned of your father's death and how that impacted them. You just mentioned economically, emotionally. Speak to that part.
Well, emotionally, it was very devastating. My parents both held education as an important aspect of living, and they had placed my older brothers in school in Montgomery, which was a nearby county, as I mentioned, because the education was inferior in Lowndes County, where we lived. So that brought my brothers home from going to school in Montgomery, and 5 of us were in school in Lowndes County. We actually heard the shots. So we were at the store, and my father was killed less than 200 yards away from where we were. So we went down to the site of the murder, and I was 5 years of age, and I actually saw my father lying in the ditch with his eyes open, deceased.
Can't imagine how a child could react to such a picture. But what I'd like for you to do again is to paint a portrait for the audience of your father as a dad, as a provider for your family, and the importance of his business entrepreneurship, even at that point, in terms of employing other individuals in the community and really making a difference in their lives.
My father never learned to read or write. He never used the pronoun I. He always spoke of himself as me. But he was very well respected in the community. He served as the chair of the deacon board of the church we were attending. He supplied rides to the churches for many of the parishioners, and therefore the churches were impacted in regards to attendance and finance because of the ability to get from one place to another. And he had the store, which served not only as one for groceries and other things, it had a large floor, and persons would come from all around surrounding communities on weekends for social entertainment. Having his life cut short changed the perspective of many, many lives at that time. People who were moving up on the social standards were cut down as well as he. So it affected us socially, emotionally, and economically, as we mentioned.
Was anyone ever arrested, convicted for the murder of your father?
Yes, one man was arrested, and that man was not indicted. So that's where the process stopped. And as I mentioned earlier, all of that was well planned. The lynching was planned. And of course, when the grand jury met, it was an all-white jury, and he was not indicted.
Crusading anti-lynching journalist Ida B. Wells wrote, "Those who commit the murders write the reports." Throughout Southern history, there was a phrase that the coroner would issue after a lynching of a Black person, and that report would say, "at the hands of unknown persons." Research notes the broad complicity of white public officials in historical violence and repression, the role of the criminal justice actors in perpetrating and enabling this type of repression. Researchers examine coroners' facilitation of white racial dominance through administrative performances, constructing white innocence. Exculpatory efforts help sustain an ideology of white innocence and institutional legitimacy by constructing white law-abiding public. And I'm curious to know, in terms of the alleged reason this individual took offense to your father's allegedly, hostile remarks to his wife, the vision or image of Black men being disrespectful to white women have really caused Black men historically to be lynched. I refer to Emmett Till whistling in Money, Mississippi at a white woman. And I'm just curious to know your thoughts about when we say at the hands of unknown persons, in this case, we know that at least one person went before a grand jury. But in terms of the picture that it paints of Black men being lynched, in this case, your father, and justice delayed and justice denied, what do you think?
There's an important book about what you're asking that was written by Margaret Burnham. And in it, she says, by hands now known, because all of these were by hands known. The sheriff did not have to look for the persons who committed the crime. They already knew who was going to do it before it happened. My brother wrote down a tag number in the sand of the car that had come to our store with the murderers in it. And they ignored what he had written because they knew. So it is not true by hands unknown. The sheriffs and all of the public officials actually were participants in the lynchings back then.
Information of the sort that we're talking about is uncomfortable, though necessary, for the broader public consumption to teach about the tragedies, lynchings of African-Americans in the past, and to some extent, even presently. There's a current movement to ban certain books that detail the impact of racism and racial violence on the African-American community. I'd like to get your thoughts on the possibility of banning such books or publications or stories that paint a poignant picture of the racial discrimination and murder and lynching of Black people.
Very definitely. The 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah Jones is an example of the book banned, one of the books that's being banned presently. And my father's story is in that 1619 Project. It's in a chapter called Inheritance. And one of the things that we have to realize because of this is that we have to be more vocal in teaching our children and our grandchildren what has transpired. In the 1619 project, my mother and father are pictured centerfold. And by the way, Nicole Hannah Jones is going to be our keynote speaker for our gala, our fundraiser this year, October the 18th. And it's open to the public, and we're certainly hoping people will come to our event. It's on my website. So that is a perfect example of books being banned and why. Establishment, so to speak, does not want people in general, whites and blacks, to know how we, as slaves who came over in 1619, built America. So our mission statement says that we are going to ensure that the history that has been hidden will come to light. And so there are a lot of books being banned. The library associations are withdrawing certain rights, anything that has the words diversity, inclusion, DEI, equity in it. So there's a major problem in the United States with trying to make sure that our history is not known. The Alabama Historical Association started a project called History Revealed. And that project has set out to show some of the instances where Black history and other histories have been erased. And for that reason, the school that was donated to my foundation, the Lounsborough School, received a historic marker April 20th, and it was called a History Reveal marker because the former slave who founded the school and founded Selma University and founded several Baptist associations, his history is not even known to the public. The people at Selma University don't even have his name in their history. The archivist knows nothing about this. So it's a big, major effort now to unveil the history that's trying to be banned, not only in books, but in most literature.
If you're ever away from your favorite radio station, you can find Like It Is on the NV1 app for Apple and Android. My guest is Josephine Bowling McCall, and she is speaking about the tragic lynching of her father. And I want now you to talk a bit about the Elmo Bowling Initiative Incorporated, 501c3 organization that is established, and its mission and purpose. I know you started on that, but let's expand a bit on its mission, purpose, and why it was started.
Thank you so very much for the opportunity to talk about the initiative. Once my family and I, installed the historic marker to recognize my father as a lynch victim in 2007, in 2008, we started, at that time it was called a foundation, and we've since changed the name to initiative. And our major emphases have been on education and evolved to restoration and preservation, and also to rural broadband. And that is because, but we'll start with the rural broadband because that was the first thing that the initiative started on. We wanted to give laptops to all of the children in Lowndes County Public Schools, which is 98-99% Black. But with that realization, we found that there was no broadband in Lowndes County. So the students would have laptops and not be able to use them. So our initiative concentrated on trying to bring broadband to Lowndes County. And then subsequently, we're working with 17 Black Belt counties to bring broadband, especially since the Biden administration has focused on underserved and unserved communities. So that's been a major aspect of our mission. And we have a project that we call Education essentials. And that's the project that we started out with the laptops, and we have expanded it through literacy tutoring. We do ACT preparation, scholarships, and parental involvement. And we want to expand our work in education so that it'll be a model for how other poor rural communities can improve education outcomes. And I did mention the Lounsboro School, which was founded by a former slave in 1867 and existed in churches until 1883, when it became a freestanding building of its own. And that building was donated to our Foundation for Preservation and Restoration. It is on the National Register of Historic Places and the Alabama Register, of course. And we are seeking to use one of the rooms in that building as a museum. We have artifacts from the 1800s, from the founder and the teachers. And also the other room we plan to use as a technology center. We are going to have 8 computer stations, and we have people who have never seen computers in Lowndes County and other counties, remote counties, but they all have cell phones. So we plan to teach how to use a computer, what a computer is, how to do telemedicine, all aspects of being, and of course, job opportunities, how to do applications and apply for jobs. So those are the major prongs of our mission at this time. Restoration and preservation of the Lounsboro School, the educational essentials that we work on with the Lowndes County school system, and especially the rural broadband project, where we're trying to get where everybody can have the necessity of life, which is being able to communicate.
So you are bridging the digital divide in so many ways that you've just explained, yes?
Yes.
In terms of helping to provide this information to the young minds who will be the leaders of tomorrow, are you getting feedback, positive feedback from the audience and from individuals that you're working with, that the story and your effort is really catching hold?
Yes, and also we have seen evidences of change in the community, and the racial climate has improved very much so since we have been involved. The Equal Justice Initiative had a project where they want every person who has been lynched to have a historic marker. They had identified about 16 people, to include my father, and they wanted historic markers put up for those people. And in that process, we had to develop a community aggregate of people, diverse group. And in that group, we had both races. And since that time, we found that a Confederate monument that was in the town courthouse square was removed. And you know, there's a fine of $25,000 for removing a Confederate marker. A white couple paid that fine. And so we are seeing some changes in the interactions among the races as a result of our foundation. And with the scholarships that we offer, our students have to research Elmo Bolin and be able to talk about what characteristics that he possessed and use those to formulate how their behavior should be affected in regards to economics because of the way Elmo Bolin worked, and education and enterprises. So we are delighted to say that we believe that we've been able to see changes in the students as far as even being interested in the history. There was a book that was written prior to mine by Hassan Jeffries called Bloody Lounge. And his book told a story about how SNCC came into Lowndes County when there were no registered voters, and SNCC was able to get 5,000 people registered to vote. Our children don't know anything about that because that history is being banned. So if we don't teach our children and help them to know about what we've gone through, the knowledge will be lost. So that is one of the main things that our organization intends to do, is to keep in the forefront of the young minds what we've gone through and what we still need to do and how to work to achieve the goals.
I tend to believe or think that your father's very proud of you and your family and your effort. What would you say to that?
I would smile and say, I surely hope so. I would say, I really truly hope so, because that was the intent, Dr. Franklin. Once I finished my research, one of my friends asked me, now that you've done all of this work, what do you plan to do about it? And I said to her, I want the world to know that this black man was lynched because he was too prosperous to be a Negro. He had not committed a crime, was not suspected of a crime, was just making a good living for his family. And that was the reason he was lynched. So I'm surely hoping so. And you got a smile on my face.
My guest, Josephine Bowling McCall of the Elmore Bowling Initiative Incorporated. She's been my guest. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
If you ever find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find this episode of Like It Is and many more on your favorite podcast app. I want to thank listeners who have kept Like It Is on air for 30 years. I'm here for you, and I want to hear from you. Send me a message on www.greenthumbfoundationinc.com. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.